where European leaders visit Ukraine while NATO works to provide more help for Ukrainian forces.
Our focus now is on support to Ukraine, to provide military support, lethal, non-lethal support.
And later in the program, talk of trillions of dollars in assistance to rebuild Ukraine's destroyed infrastructure, modeled on a U.S. post-World War II program.
Clearly, there are big challenges when we talk now about the possible Marshall Plan for Ukraine.
Today is Thursday, June 16th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Herman. Four European leaders are in Ukraine, where their agenda included a meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to discuss further international support for Ukraine's military. Leaders from France, Germany, Italy, and Romania arrived overland in Kiev amid the sound of air raid sirens Thursday. The visit, seen as belated by some critics, came as Western European powers also are perceived as not having provided Kyiv with the scale of weaponry needed by the Ukrainians. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov on Thursday said Russia hoped the European leaders in Kyiv would not just focus on discussing support for Ukraine in terms of weapons supplies, commenting that such an approach would be absolutely useless and only prolong people's suffering and further damage the country. French President Emmanuel Macron, touring the war-racked suburb of Irpin, denounced the barbarism of the Russian attacks there, praising the courage of residents of towns in the Kyiv region who held back the invaders from attacking the capital.
Massacres have been perpetrated, and we have the first traces of what are the war crimes. In this investigation, we are also cooperating very strongly. I would like to thank all the French gendarmes, experts, and magistrates who have been deployed from the first days alongside the experts.
Alongside Macron in Kyiv, Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi and Romanian President Klaus Iohannis and the Chancellor of Germany Olaf Scholz. The German leader expressed his horror of the devastation he viewed.
It is a terrible war, and Russia is pushing it forward with the utmost brutality, without regard for human life. And that is what must come to an end. With all the activities that we are doing, with all the aid that has been mobilized, but also with the sanctions, and all of this together should help to ensure that international solidarity gives Ukrainian citizens the opportunity to rebuild their country.
Scholz also confirmed on Thursday that Zelensky is to take part in the Group of Seven Leaders Summit Germany is hosting in the Bavarian Alps from June 26th. Meanwhile, European Union leaders are preparing to make a decision next week on Ukraine's request to become a candidate for EU membership. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, following a defense minister's meeting in Brussels, welcomed the trip by the European leaders to Kyiv, calling it a message of solidarity and part of the wide cooperation between allies and Ukraine to respond to the Russian invasion.
Our focus now is on support to Ukraine, to provide military support, lethal, non-lethal support from allies and from NATO, and also on capacity building, and this helped to modernize more for the longer term the defense and security institutions of Ukraine. Let me add one more thing, and that is that NATO allies have provided support to Ukraine since 2014. Training tens of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers and also help to equip and strengthen the Ukrainian armed forces. It's first and foremost the bravery, the courage of the Ukrainian armed forces that are now able to fight back against the invading Russian forces, but the NATO support for many years is also making a huge difference on the battleground every day.
Before the NATO leaders' meeting in Spain, the Defense Alliance, predicts Stoltenberg, Stoltenberg will reach agreement on a new force model.
I am confident that within 2 weeks at the summit we will agree a force model, and not only a model, but also that allies are ready to provide the necessary forces to fill that model with content, with strength, with forces that will reassure all allies that we are delivering across the whole alliance, not only the East, on a strengthening of our deterrence and defense in a more dangerous and competitive world.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, following Thursday's NATO ministers' meeting, characterized the war started by Russia in Ukraine as an enormous crisis in European security, but said the defense alliance has risen to the challenge of Putin's war of choice and Russia's assault on transatlantic security.
Our allies have activated NATO's defense plans. They've deployed elements of the NATO response force, and they've placed tens of thousands of troops in the eastern areas of the alliance, along with significant air and naval assets under the direct command of NATO and supported by allies' national deployments. And NATO is also making plans to strengthen its deterrence and defense posture for the longer term, especially along the eastern flank.
Austin added he is confident NATO members will overcome past shortcomings of logistical challenges to rapidly deploy forward forces.
There are things that we can do and will do to make sure that it's a lot easier to rapidly deploy forces forward. Some of those things include pre-positioning of equipment, putting forces that are at home station on higher levels of alert, streamlining command and control so that it's easier to fall in on a formation. So recognizing the challenges of the past, I think, you know, all of our allies have learned from any shortcomings that we may have experienced in the past. And they'll build to ensure that they have the right capabilities to provide flexible and responsible and combat-credible forces when the time comes.
Ukraine's president is expressing gratitude for the latest military aid package announced by the United States, totaling more than $1 billion. But he says still more is needed at this critical time. In his nightly video message to the nation, Zelensky says that during the 112 days of war, the Ukrainian army has proven that courage and wisdom on the battlefield, together with the ability to tactically outplay the enemy, has produced significant results, despite the Russian army's significant advantage in the number of soldiers and equipment. He adds, "Of course, we will do everything to outdo these current advantages. Every day I struggle for Ukraine to get the weapons and equipment it needs." The latest American package, announced Wednesday, includes 18 155-millimeter howitzers with 36,000 rounds of ammunition, additional ammunition for high-mobility artillery rocket systems, a pair of Harpoon coastal defense systems, and thousands of night vision devices, thermal sights, and other optics. U.S. President Joe Biden informed Zelensky of the additional weaponry during a 41-minute phone call Wednesday. John Kirby, the National Security Council's strategic communications coordinator, speaking from the White House, explained there will likely be additional such assistance from the United States depending on the changing needs of the Ukrainian military.
We're just now beginning to spend on the $40 billion supplemental that Congress approved, and we're grateful for that, of course. You will see additional packages coming on a fairly routine basis here, and we want to meter it out so that we're in lockstep with the Ukrainians and where they are on the battlefield and what they need in real time. That's why conversations like today with President Zelensky are so important. The contact group that Secretary Austin is hosting right now in Brussels, 50-some-odd nations also putting forward other materials for security assistance. But you need to do it because it's a war and it's active combat and it changes from day to day. You kind of need to do it in almost real time.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a statement notes that with this latest package, the total U.S. security assistance to Ukraine is now more than $5.6 billion since Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th. This month marks the 75-year anniversary of a speech by then-U.S. Secretary of State George Marshall, which launched the post-World War II European aid program that became known as the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan is recognized as a success story of economic growth and democratization. There are diplomats, academics, and others who are discussing the need for a new Marshall Plan for Ukraine and other countries in Eastern Europe, and possibly the Balkans, in the aftermath of the devastation being caused by Russia's invasion of its neighbor. This was discussed at length earlier this week in Washington at a seminar hosted by the Wilson Institute, marking the Marshall Plan's anniversary. Wolfgang Petrich is president of the Austrian Marshall Plan Foundation.
Clearly, there are big challenges when we talk now about the possible Marshall Plan for Ukraine. There are many reasons. First of all, we're still in the middle of the war, and I'm very much concerned about how to end this war. I think we are now confronted with a situation which is very different from the total defeat of Nazi Germany, and in extension Austria, which was part of Nazi Germany at the time. I am afraid a total defeat is not, I don't see it in fact. So we'll have to deal with something, and we have to be prepared for a situation where we'll have an extended period of, euphemistically called, unpeace, but more so maybe a conflict between Russia and the West.
Derek Hogan, the principal deputy assistant secretary of the State Department's Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, notes the original Marshall Plan 75 years ago was a $13 billion pledge over 4 years, which is more than $120 billion in today's dollars. For Ukraine and the region, the United States has made what he calls a similar commitment, with the assistance funds the United States is using from two supplemental bills in just the last 3 months coming to $53.6 billion. And there's more in the pipeline, approximately $1.5 billion per month over the next 4 to 5 months.
The goals of the Marshall Plan were the same as our shared goals for Europe today. That is, ensuring mutual economic prosperity, providing for transatlantic security, promoting our shared values, and working together to confront global challenges.
Jonathan Katz, a senior fellow with the German Marshall Fund, notes the economic costs of the devastation in Ukraine pale in comparison to the tens of billions of dollars already sent or pledged by Washington, and much of the heavy lifting will need to be done by the European community.
The EU and a potential EU membership, full membership, is really critical for Ukraine in a number of ways. One, to deal with the macro assistance side. Europe is really, maybe more so than even the United States, has the resources to provide the type of support Ukraine is going to need. We didn't talk about overall funding levels. In late April, it was reported, I think the Ukrainian government said, that they said it was about $600 billion in damage done. That was in late April. It's likely over $1 trillion or close to $1 trillion today. So Europe is going to have to play this critical role in providing the support of any type of Marshall Plan.
Joining me now on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine to further discuss this is Romina Bandura, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and an economist with more than 2 decades of experience in international development research, policy analysis, and project management. She is a co-author of a current CSIS article titled The 10 Most Pressing Questions for Ukraine's Economic Reconstruction. Welcome to the program. We are hearing some pretty big numbers in the trillions of dollars being thrown around. Certainly that'll be beyond Ukraine's capacity, and there is this talk of a new U.S. Marshall Plan and assistance from the European Union. Romina, is this going to be feasible?
Yes, I think it's going to be feasible if we start planning now. And it's not just going to be one country putting all the money. As you mentioned at the beginning, it'll be United States, and our allies putting the money up for the reconstruction.
One thing we have to talk about is Ukraine, post-Soviet Union, hasn't had the best reputation for transparency. In fact, the level of corruption has been notorious. Perhaps it's been cleaned up to some extent under President Zelensky, but he is also fighting a war right now, obviously. How optimistic are you, considering your extensive background in these sort of big international aid projects, that Ukraine won't end up resembling Afghanistan in terms of fraud, waste, and corruption?
Ukraine is very different than Afghanistan. Yes, it has corruption. So does Eastern European countries. And even in the United States, we look at the COVID checks, we had corruption there too. So Ukraine does have problems of transparency, but in the past years, it has done a lot of reforms. It has a very strong civil society, investigative journalism, and very strong human capital and internal institutional capacity to really tackle the issues of corruption, which everybody is obviously talking about. And also the way that the reconstruction is going to be implemented could also have a lot of safeguards so that that money is really flowing to the projects and to the people that need the reconstruction resources.
There's also talk here in Washington about using those seized Russian assets to fund part of Ukraine's reconstruction. Will that be easy to implement?
I am not a legal expert, but from what I've been researching and talking to experts, it's going to be very difficult to seize that money for reconstruction. So I'm not very hopeful on that front. And even we heard this week that a lot of the people that have sanctions and frozen assets were able to circumvent the sanctions through the use of, you know, shell companies and all these gimmicks. So it's not going to be very easy to use that money. That's my assessment.
And certainly it wouldn't add up anyway to the trillions of dollars that people are talking about.
You know, we need to think about the money. It's not just going to be grants, but we need to also think about different financial instruments for Ukraine. A portion might be free money or grants, but a portion can also be in some soft loans, guarantees, and equity investments. We have different financial tools that can give Ukraine and support the reconstruction.
Thank you, Romina Bandura, for your insight on today's program.
Thank you, Stephen, for having me on your program. It's been a pleasure.
Listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine, I'm Steve Herman. A record 89.3 million people had been driven from their homes by war, violence, persecution, and human rights abuse by the end of 2021, up 8% from the previous year, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency's annual Global Trends Report. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva that the Russian invasion of Ukraine is now adding to the misery.
UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi says the figures are made even worse when the number of people forced to flee by Russia's invasion of Ukraine is included.
And Ukraine has displaced anyway between 12 and 14 million people, depending on how you count them. So the figure has exceeded 100 million. That this is due to a rise in conflicts and crises.
Emergencies have caused the numbers to climb every year over the past decade. The UNHCR says Russia's Ukraine invasion has spurred the fastest and one of the largest forced displacement crises since World War II. While the world is focused on Ukraine, Grandi urges governments to pay attention to the many emergencies that have preceded Ukraine and continue to shatter the lives of millions of people.
We had Ethiopia at the end of 2020 and through 21. We had the Afghanistan situation in the summer of last year, Syria, for example, South Sudan, the question of Palestine refugees. These have been very long-standing crises that add to the numbers.
The UNHCR says refugee numbers rose to more than 27 million last year, while those displaced by conflict within their own countries increased to 53.2 million. Dispelling common perceptions, the UNHCR says more than 80% of refugees fled to poor and middle-income countries. The report finds five countries, Syria, Venezuela, Afghanistan, South Sudan, and Myanmar, account for more than two-thirds of the globally displaced. It says Turkey took in the most refugees, followed by Colombia, Uganda, Pakistan, and Germany. The United States is still the top refugee resettlement country in the world. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Russians occupied the Ukrainian village of Yehinne in the early days of the invasion. When they were driven out in late March, the residents who endured the occupation began telling their story. Anna Kostutschenko reports from the Cherniv region of Ukraine.
This is Yehinne, a village some 20 kilometers south of Chernihiv in northern Ukraine. On March 5th, Russian troops occupied Yehinne. Таисия Петрівна says they came suddenly. Armed Russian soldiers ordered Petrivna and her disabled husband to move to the basement of a local school.
At about 4 p.m., they came in holding guns. I think there were three of them. They said, take away your old man now.
Russian soldiers forced all the villagers into the school basement. 360 people, including 77 children, in 200 square meter space. Villagers didn't know they would spend almost a month there. Adults were forced to sleep sitting up because there was no room to lie down. School caretaker Ivan Polguy was among them.
There used to be benches here. A disabled person was laying here. Three people basically died over there.
Some of the older people died of oxygen deprivation. Some wrote their names on the walls to remember. Soon six names were added to that list, those of young villagers shot by Russian soldiers.
Yanuk was executed, Grishenko executed, Radchenko died from an explosion, Viktor Shevchenko executed, Tolik Shevchenko, his brother.
Russian soldiers let locals leave the basement once a day to use the bathroom. Ukrainian troops liberated the village on March 31st. Taisia returned to her apartment to find it hadn't been empty while she was gone.
Five people of Buryat origin lived in my home.
Russian soldiers left chaos and unsanitary conditions behind after they left, she recalls.
They filled up the toilet bowl with towels. I had to dig everything out.
Taisia's neighbor managed to get out before the occupation and is still too afraid to return. Her apartment was occupied as well. The Russians took household appliances, tools, bed linens, men's clothes, and even shoes, Taisia says. At the beginning of the occupation, they forced villagers to hand over their phones, threatening execution.
If you do not give us the means of communication, they said, we will get your young men and execute every other one.
Taisia's apartment was ransacked, but at least her home is still standing, she says. About one-third of homes in Yehinne were destroyed, and there is unexploded ordnance in parts of the village. Anna Kostuchenko for Voice of American News, Chernihiv region, Ukraine.
That's all for today's program. You can stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on our social media platforms, follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman. Good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.